Hello, and welcome to Witch Hunt, the podcast that explores historic witchcraft trials and modern witch hunts in search of an end to witch hunting in all forms. I'm Josh Hutchinson.
And I'm Sarah Jack.
We're descendants of people accused of witchcraft.
And we're here to tell stories of people like them.
We cover the past, present, and future of witch hunting.
Witch hunting dates back thousands of years.
The practice occurred all across the ancient world.
And continued through the classical era and the medieval period.
In Europe, witch trials ramped up in the early modern period and resulted in the deaths of tens of thousands.
But witch hunts also have occurred in other parts of the world, and they've never stopped anywhere.
Witch hunts, now mostly unsanctioned, occur in all corners of the globe today, killing thousands per year.
As historian Wolfgang Beringer has stated, there have never been so many witch hunts as we see in today's world.
Today's guest is Danny Buck, who introduces us to the witch trials of astrologer Mark Prynne of Great Yarmouth, England.
Along the way, we'll meet an interesting cast of characters and learn about astrology's role in 17th century England.
Danny tells us about the golden age of astrology and the great astrologers of England in the 17th century.
He shares the different perspectives on astrology, including the impact of Puritan beliefs on the perception of astrology.
We'll learn what astrological products exist and what their uses are.
Today, we focus on the intriguing figure of Mark Prynne, who was an amateur astrologer who was involved in locating lost goods and helping his neighbors determine the future.
We'll also learn about the antagonist to Mark Prynne, a MP named Miles Corbett. We'll learn about his leading role in the witch hunts and the accusation specifically against Mark Prynne. We'll also learn how he was satirized by poet John Taylor, who wrote a book called A Brief Relation of the Idiotisms and Absurdities of Miles Corbett, Esquire, Counselor at Law, Recorder, and Burgess for Great Yarmouth.
This is the podcast's second visit to the witch hunt of 1645 in Great Yarmouth. Dr. Buck is going to give us an overview of the witch hunt, where Mark Prynne faced allegations of practicing sorcery and using witchcraft. We will also hear about a second round of accusations in the spring of 1646.
And we'll conclude by learning the aftermath of the witch hunt, including the fates of both Mark Prynne and Miles Corbett.
Welcome. The first guest of Witch Hunt, returning favorite, Dr. Danny Buck, a Norfolk research historian specializing in the connection between witch hunting, politics, and religious division. In his previous appearance, he kicked off episode 6 with a discussion on witch hunting during the English Civil War in Great Yarmouth, the place where William and Joanna Talon began their family before relocating to the New World and settling in Salem Village. Make sure to revisit that fantastic episode. In this discussion, Dr. Buck delves further into the religious and political conflicts that shaped the Great Yarmouth Witch Trial of amateur astrologer Mark Prynne.
How was astrology perceived in early modern Great Yarmouth, and why was it important?
There's the three elements which I find very interesting about how astrology was perceived. At one level, it's something that seems very useful to ordinary people. We've got records going back as far as the 16th century of a man called William Wycherley, who admitted he did conjure in the Great Circle with a sword and ring consecrated, and Thomas Aldring of Yarth, who was a conjurer and have good books of conjuring, who people were going to visit. They were seeking to understand the future and also search for lost property. For others, it was actually a way of looking for their, using predictions to look at their medical health. So find a diagnosis and seek medical treatment. As we're going to look at, for some people, this element of astrology cutting into conjuring, the act of charms and raising spirits for advice, is cutting into witchcraft, that you're not just looking to do predictable science, understanding God's plan for the universe through the stars, but in fact, actually asking the dead for advice, or even devils. Finally, there were some people rather cynical about this, even by the middle of the 17th century. People who are thinking that astrology is nothing but a con trick, a way for illiterate peasants or gullible guests to seek lost things from someone who could tell them what they wanted to hear, probably closer to our idea of cold reading. Someone who can speak the names of the constellations enough to seem educated or have some secret knowledge over the rest of them.
What was the golden age of astrology?
This is a difficult question. Obviously, astrology has been something that we can go all the way back to ancient Mesopotamia, not earlier. People have always looked to the stars and tried to seek meaning in them. We think of things like Halley's Comet being seen just before the Battle of Hastings as an ill omen for the Saxons. But the 17th century introduced a couple of elements that made astrology more accurate, or at least to those who believed in it. Accurate clocks meant that birth dates would not be a vague day, be put down right to the hour. Increasingly accurate telescopes and astronomical, as opposed to astrological, equipment was being invented that meant that stars could be understood in ever greater clarity and purpose. I think it was Bernard Kapp who said that the last of the astrologers were the first of the astronomers. I think a very famous astrologer for the court in Poland, Copernicus, started off as the court astrologer. This meant that you could ask for a birth chart from an astrologer, and you could put it down to the minute, and therefore get what would seem to be an increasingly accurate diagnosis. But also, because of the printing press, astrology became ever more accessible to the ordinary person. The astrologer I want to talk about today, Mark Print, started his career with basically like a dummy's first guide of how to look at the stars. Something, a brief of Molson's Almanac. So again, as opposed to the full book, it's a brief, so it's been shortened and made more accessible for the ordinary reader, as opposed to the larger original, I think it's originally a 15th century French almanac.
What other products did astrologers create?
The most obvious one is the element of prediction, which is by casting a chart. This isn't a particularly visual medium, but you can often see them that survive in this period, often with a square with a circle inside or some pattern of that, which is then used to reflect the houses of the stars and their positions and how that therefore interacts with the balance of the humours and health, as well as person's personality. Again, I'd say often tend to be a bit more circular, but they still are used by people. You also have the almanac itself. So the almanac is an interesting product. Obviously, we still produce almanacs for people. Some of them are not astrological, just to tell us what's happened in a year, cricketing almanacs, etc. But for the 17th century almanacs, these are being produced annually, often being used to record dates, which are important for people to know, and how far we are from the creation of the world or the birth of Christ, etc. But they're also used to look at conjunctions. What are the weird astronomical phenomena that are going to occur? And actually, these take on quite a political element. I was just catching up today in preparation for this, and there's a wonderful piece by Imogen Peck called A Chronology of Some Memorable Accidents, the Representation of the Recent Past in English Almanacs, which looks at how, in the aftermath of the Civil War, people were still looking at the past through almanacs in a way that reflected their own political biases. However, this was a lot more complex during the Civil War itself, when there were a variety of rival almanacs. In particular, William Linley is famous because he produced an almanac that showed how the stars were showing that Parliament's victory was imminent, but he did have a royalist rival producing his own, believing evidence of royalist victory, which unsurprisingly he fell into obscurity while Lilly, with a somewhat more accurate prognosis, continued to thrive. These weren't particularly expensive objects. They're almost mass-produced, what we refer to often as ephemera, so relatively cheap paper, but were being produced through the stationers' companies. They'd often rely on family names, families of astrologers. So in particular in Great Yarmouth, we have Geoffrey Lanive starting in 1604, On his death in 1613, his nephew Geoffrey, with a J, continued the almanacs until he was dismissed for being a bit dodgy in the local corporation. And his cousin John Neave took over, continuing the almanac from 1626 until 61. So these reliable names meant that people could trust them. And again, it's something that continues until at least the 18th century. I think Benjamin Franklin, of the American Revolutionary fame, got his start faking an almanac claiming the original author had died, he was replacing him in his usual slightly trollish way. And then on top of this, we get some bigger publications. We've mentioned Lilly's Christian Astrology, mostly with these different guides how to and involvement. It's quite interesting because, again, some of these do bring up witchcraft and the ways that astrology can be used against them. Finally, we've got that medical product, that its ability to accurately understand people's maladies was quite important. In particular, I find it quite interesting a reference in the Great Yav Corporation book to Mark Prynne helping a distracted man in the town's Bridewell. So this is the poor relief, the precursor to the workhouse. And again, distracted, it's a very vague term, but suggests some kind of mental illness that somehow this astrological conjunction. And again, it fits into our sort of later idea of things like lunacy and that connection between the stars and mental health that still remains current into the 19th century. Finally, there's this element of what they could do for you. Well, they can find the things you've lost. So in particular, we know that Mark Prynne found a variety of objects. It's been satirized by poets afterwards that he could find anything from a carp to a windmill or a millstone. But certainly there's evidence of finding things like a man called John Spark, a sailor nearby, who what had a lost hat, a cushion, and I think a gold ring. So these are an interesting variety of small items that could be easily lost. Again, you don't know how much this is cold reading, that he's somehow be able to talk to them, is able to deduce what's going on. Or again, if he's being consulted, he's not necessarily successful.
It's interesting. You mentioned William Lilly, and I just want to point out that one of his books showed up in Connecticut in a witch trial of Catherine Harrison and was used as evidence against her.
That is fascinating. I find that astrologers are they are the more acceptable side of magic. At least your fishermen, your lilies, and they've got a high status. They're protected by, they've got connections. William Lilly, he claimed that he'd spoken to King Charles and advised him to not try and escape Carisbrook Castle. It's easy to say after the event, but he also advised parliamentarian generals. And again, there doesn't need to be anything therefore incompatible for some people with astrology. But there was also a fear. William Lilly as well mentions there was fear he was accused of being a juggling wizard and imposter. There's a fear about them being compared to necromancers, so being able to somehow predict using the dead. And again, there's an early generation they're responding to, men like John Dee and John Lamb, who are certainly in this box of people who are engaging in dark magic and dark practices that was unacceptable. Judith Bonzel, in her guide to William Lilly's life, mentions that he is someone who is afraid of this line. And in particular, he offers anti-witchcraft medical treatment, which actually is quite interesting because it's very much linked to the kind of witch bottles, which obviously we've looked at before, where he mentions the need to boil the patient's urine together with pins, nail parings, and the hair of the victim as a remedy against witchcraft. But he gave the example that's a relatively scientific explanation. These are natural experiments and work by sympathy in order to torment the witch and draw out of hiding, which then, in theory, brought relief to the victim. And of course, the most recent volume of Lilly publications came out in the 1680s, so in time to be influencing the beliefs of people in Salem.
Who was Mark Prynne?
So I've mentioned him a couple of times now. I've found him a wonderful figure. He's one of these people that just jumps out of the records in a really interesting way. Again, I'm very grateful to Peter Elmer, the excellent historian of witchcraft, who's sadly retired now, and getting a chance to speak to him when I was at the UEA. And he brought this to our attention. He, again, in his index to his wonderful Politics and Witchcraft, he brought up a lot of the details I'm going to rely on. We are always able to see so far because we're studying on the shoulders of giant. But he is a fascinating figure. He's definitely an amateur astrologer. Unlike Leneve, unlike Lilly, it is his full-time job. He's mostly a tenant farmer in the town. He's renting land from the local ministry at one point and using that. So this is almost like a sideline, as the Americans say, a side hustle to provide a little bit of extra income. So we don't know much about his family, where he's come from. We do know he's educated because he's noted as having a very large collection of books for the time, of theological, historical, and philosophical books. Again, he particularly mentions Wordsworth's Almanac, who we've described as a brief of the famed shepherds. And we know he's being employed by local residents. So we've got hats, pillows, are definitely being searched for. John Taylor claims a lost cow, calf, horse or cart, silver spoon or bodkin, knife or ring, millstone, windmill, cork. But I think he, again, is being a little bit ridiculous. We know he's being paid 30 shillings, which is quite a lot of money, for curing one Tills, the distracted man who I mentioned earlier. And we know that this medical treatment is already current with people like Leneve. This all suggests he is in demand. He is someone who's being employed quite regularly, even if this isn't his full-time career.
What do we need to know about his landlord, the minister?
We're very lucky that there's an interesting connection here. Fryn is renting land from Matthew Brooks. Matthew Brooks, as we mentioned a little bit last time, was a very lordly minister in a town that was very Puritan. So they did not get on well. So he arrives at the town in 1630 in the middle of a crisis where they're trying to handle the presence of the town's Puritan minister who's being pushed to one side by the Dean and Chapter of Norwich, the more lordly authorities. And he starts making a splash pretty early. By December 1631, he marches into the church and reads the 1627 injunctions against the Puritan minister, which means he's then arrested by the town's corporation. So in particular, Henry Davy, Thomas Green, Ezekiel Harris, and a man who we're definitely going to come back to later, Miles Corbett. Because of this, he sends a petition to the king. He's supported to the hilt, and in response, those people arrested him were arrested in turn for a while. The king sides with Brooks, he gets authority from it. Brooks works very closely with the Bishop of Norwich, Wren, from 1635 onwards, and he carries out a campaign that's really aggressively anti-Puritan. He makes the church look nice, he brings in stained glass windows, he gets rid of the raised seating used by the Puritan authorities that could look down on the folk of Yarmouth and keep an eye on them, make sure they're behaving properly in church. And this feud between Brooks and Corbett deepens in 1637 when Corbett is accused of harbouring two emigre nonconformist ministers, so it's real religious radicals, who'd come over to Great Yarmouth, smuggled in a lot of anti-Laudian books and hidden, pretending to be soldiers who'd been fighting the Netherlands. And they take dinner in Miles Corbett's house, allegedly. Brooks is very diligent about investigating it, like a little detective. This gets worse in 1640 as Wren, his bishop protege, has moved on to Ely. And obviously with the collapse of the royal government and the collapse of the episcopacy, the Church of England, there's a lot of tension with the locals. And we are helped by what for me is a lovely document, a very fascinating document, from the parliamentary archives, as he writes a petition to the House of Lords saying, can you stop them bullying me? It's not great stuff for Brooks. Brooks, sadly, I think at one point he mentions he's being threatened by the wife of the alderman, that she's going to throw lime and blind him, lime in his eyes, along with sand. His assistant, Thomas Cheshire, who we're going to come back to, is being... when he's walked through the very narrow streets in Great Yarmouth, which are called rows that go up and down to allow easy fishing in the town. He's jostled. He's got people slamming their elbows into his back. And he's forced to leave in 1638. The saddest example, people forgive my tangent because this is such a rich colour. That while Brooks has gone to London to defend himself about attempts to try and remove him, there's a large group of angry drunken locals get together. A big bonfire outside his house. They go to Ezekiel Harris, who obviously holds this grudge against Brooks, and they get roaring drunk. He provides them with massive beer. They then turn up to this bonfire, especially three of them in disguise as the three most important people in the kingdom. Considering this is 1640, I think it's likely you've got the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Lord, because he gets mentioned later, the king, and probably Black Tom Strafford, the Earl of Wentworth. So they're having this massive party. They obviously, Brooks isn't there. Instead, it's just his housemate and his poor, heavily pregnant wife and their eight children, terrified. These mass mob come start knocking on the door, demanding entry in the name of the Archbishop Canterbury, presumably the man in costume. So again, there's a real tension already, this desire to purge the town of people they see as dangerous and too lenient and not Puritan enough. And it's this crowd that Prynne is hanging out with. So again, it's one of the things that's going to be a black spot against him with the Puritan authorities.
You mentioned Miles Corbett. Can you introduce us to him?
Miles is a fascinating figure in his own right. So he's the second son of Sir John Corbett, a baronet from Sprouston. That probably means very little to you. Hopefully there's a Sprouston somewhere in America amongst the other many English renamed settlements. But this one is a slightly unimpressive outskirt of Norwich today. But again, it's not an unpleasant place. He's a well-educated man. He goes to Christ College, Cambridge in 1612. He attends Lincoln Inn, his training as a lawyer, before being called to the bar in 1623. In 1625, he becomes the town recorder for Great Yarmouth. So that's a role which encompasses both your town's legal expert, lawyer, but also having a role acting as a judge in court cases. Obviously, it's very important we're coming back to the witch hunt. His brother was the MP for the town and was arrested by King Charles as one of the five members who resisted his call for a loan to try and sponsor the war against Spain and France. And sadly dies in prison, which again, likely one of the reasons why Corbett is so anti-government and so angry with the Church of England there, as well as his time in Cambridge. He also undertook the role for King Slim and Aldborough of Recorder, which again is quite interesting because both of those towns are towns that are touched by the witch hunt. And again, one of the things I've always wanted to do is to really get to dip and look at some of these communities, because also Southwold is well connected to Corbett. Is he someone who's helping to persuade Matthew Hopkins to come along the East Anglian coast, that all these towns which he's connected to? This is something that hopefully Marion will find the answer for that. I'm looking forward to that as part of her wonderful Seven Counties project. But he's definitely someone to keep an eye on for that. His allies might say he's a very rigorous man, legally trained, has a very important role to play in the Long Parliament. And he remains as MP up until 1660. So obviously proves himself loyal. Is involved in Ireland as well during the Commonwealth, trying to sort out land there. But for his enemies, John Taylor describes him as a stiff cathedral hater, a utopian of no religion, and whose fired zeal led him to be cruel to toothless, aged ministers. Even crueler newspapers in the 1650s were comparing him to the devil, saying he was very dark, which again, I always wonder again, he's someone from Sprouston. Is he quite swarthy? We don't know. There's a couple of lovely prints of him where he's doing all right for himself in the 1650s. He looked quite prosperous. And one of the lovely things we've got in the Norfolk archives is this little paper. It's like two pieces of A5 folded together to form a little booklet, which is rather touching because it notes the date when he was married and it notes the exact date to the hour his children were born. And obviously, this is something he kept with him, which I find very sweet. He's a very human figure despite all this. So his role with the witch hunt, obviously then we've said that he's the recorder. He's the one gathering the evidence. He's also in his role as town clerk. He's keeping an eye on the papers. And he's like the person who sent the invitation to Hopkins to come to Great Yarmouth in the first place. So he's deeply enmeshed. As we look, there's accusations. He took a much deeper personal interest in the case against Mark Prynne.
What kind of charges were brought against Mark Prynne?
So in 1638, he's first accused of using charms to locate the lost goods of one John Spark, a sailor. But in 1645, he faced the much more serious allegations of practicing sorcery, to using witchcraft to locate lost goods belonging to Anne Can and John Ringer, who's a mason. He's also indicted for using witchcraft on John Howlett, a goldsmith, and his son, also named John, conveniently, who were both sick at the time of the trial.
Since it's been a while since we spoke about the 1645 witch hunt, can you refresh our memories with a brief overview of that?
So it starts in the 22nd of April in 1645 with Howlett and his son John being sort of the first people to make their accusations of witchcraft. This leads to eventually 10 people being accused. 6 convicted, of which 5 are hanged for the crime. There's also a second round of accusations in the spring of 1646. 6 are made, but all 6 of them are found not guilty.
And how did the community respond to the allegations against Prynne?
As far as I can tell, early on, there seems to be this support, the growing support after this, that there's increasing numbers of accusations that follow this. So we have a few more people, as we noted, accusers being brought, not just Howlett and his son. But the trial itself, we have an account of Thomas Cheshire, so the man who'd been the assistant to Brooks, arriving and giving testimony, defending. It's the kind of defense where this man isn't a witch, he's just a con man, but it's still better than being hanged. So there does seem to be some people willing to rally in his support. And obviously he's found not guilty. So obviously the jury are convinced that he isn't someone who's engaged in witchcraft.
What kind of evidence would they have presented against him?
So from the collection, from the account we've got, obviously we have the trial records. We know people are speaking in evidence for and against. But in particular, we have an account, a hostile account to Miles Corbett, that mentions that the evidence being brought in front of the jury included Prynne's collection of astrological books. So we've mentioned Molson's Almanac. We've also got a book of merry fortune telling with the forms of dice and stars. Also something which is referred to as a book of circles. So again, presumably these are different forms of charts being used. I've spoken to some people upon this, and they suggest possibly the greater and lesser keys of Solomon, or something called the Picatrix, which are being brought in front of them as official texts. The allegation is that so the names of constellations and the names of the astrological forms sound quite demonic. Col Quintenta, Asafetida, Zazara Phila. And the allegation is that Miles Corbett is so ill-educated, he believes them bitter, stinking, and poxy devils, rather than obviously the form of the stars. He names Alabazama, Copernicus, Rombolox, and Mistopheles. So Copernicus, the astrologer, being treated as a demonic figure.
How did Puritan beliefs influence the witch hunt and the perception of astrology?
Certainly there's an element of Puritan beliefs being used to interpret astrological evidence. Obviously, we'll talk about William Lilly. William Lilly had to directly write a book called Christian Astrology, trying to seek to show this connection between astrological formations as a way to determine the future, as opposed to other forms. It's a very strict and narrow vision of what astrology could be. Previous people involved in this, obviously, we've mentioned at the start, those two controversial 16th century figures. So they've mentioned the sword and ring consecrated as magical elements that could use to foretell the future, similar to Deborah Moretti when she was talking about the carafe, that you could look into the crystal, you could look into the glass, you could see images, which is slightly more dangerous as opposed to just looking plainly at the stars. Again, compare that to our classic image of the fortune teller with the crystal ball, that these things are more dodgy. Similarly, I think John Dee allegedly had an obsidian mirror taken from the Aztecs that he could use to communicate with angels. And this is where it crossed over the line. So there is the possibility that the contemporary astrologer John Gadbury blamed pretenders for critics connecting astrology to magicians and necromancers. You have the astrologer's club, the educated types who could be reliable, and you have those slipping on the other side into magic. So be it magicians and necromancers. Also, William Lilly himself sought to reject the dark sentence of oracles. So again, you're not seeking to commune with the dead or commune with devils to tell the future. You're just doing a nice scientific analysis of the stars. Certainly in the context of the very favored imagination of the 1640s, where omens seem to be everywhere and the devil's influence everywhere, looking instead of the heavens to more otherworldly and demonic forces was the risk. And as we saw that John Taylor's account there, with that fear of constellations and devils, the two seeming interchangeable, for those who don't know quite what's going on there, then that astrology, witchcraft could seem quite similar or close enough, despite the protestations by those people who wanted to prove it otherwise.
With Miles Corbett, he was a Puritan. I'm thinking about the war that's happening, this antagonism that's between Brooks and Corbett. And then you've got this amateur astrologist, the devil in the community. I'm used to hearing how the Puritan ministers are seeing the devil in their people, but they're seeing the devil from the other side right now in this situation.
So Miles Corbett is a fascinating figure for that. So we said he's a Puritan, but he's not a Presbyterian Puritan. He's not someone who's seeking to build a new Church of England that's going to be Puritan. He's instead closer, in opinion, to the kind of American congregational churches. He becomes a leading member of Great Yarmouth Congregational Church, and that is a source of tension within the town. He writes letters to the corporation saying, why are you trying to exclude the congregational church from being part of our Puritan community? Again, this split in the godly is something that's causing increasing tension. One of the fears of the devil is that he appears as angels in raiments of light. And there we have also groups of Anabaptists in Great Yarmouth at the same time. How much conformity can you have? In some ways, seeking someone who is obviously outside the pale, you can unite around, is something important. But this is something that goes way back. The first accusations are in 1638. While Corbett already has, we'd say, congregational leanings, he's communicating with congregationalists, people looking to build a new church the New England way. That divide is only caused when there's an actual congregational church there. In this way, his role in promoting the witch hunt, in trying to seek to remove the devil, it provides a mirror to how ministers are as well, I feel. The ministers in Great Yarmouth are involved in other accusations, particularly against Elizabeth Bradwell, a woman. We can see Corbett's crusade here as something that feels very personal. But again, we have reason for thinking so because of the way it's being treated as such, that it's used as something to ridicule Corbett later for his superstition, his foolishness to get involved. But I feel, from the fact that he's so intertwined with these accusations, that is something he takes seriously. And this man who's been sitting there connected to the old regime and all its corruption provides a useful vehicle to try and engage in this process of reformation and to reunite these two different kinds of godly people to make them move in the right direction. But again, it's one of those tragedies that despite all this death that he's willing to engage in, it doesn't work really in the long term.
What is the outcome of criticism of this astrology being used by a farmer? As we know, Miles becomes a joke to some about this. What other outcomes were there?
So this is particularly interesting for me. This is what brings it to light, is that this is used as part of a campaign. There's a wonderful poet who I think we can describe in detail, John Taylor, who is in London during the 1630s. He's originally a water boatman. He basically just travels across the river in his little boat, creates ditties and witticisms, and is a very sharp wit. And now he feels a loyalty to the crown, but he also has a particular enmity against Miles Corbett and Corbett's role in London. The Civil War radicalizes him. So he starts producing political squibs toward the king and against Parliament. But Taylor was arrested by Corbett and the Lord Mayor of London for seditious words against the five members, the people who the king tried to arrest in 1642, precipitating the Civil War. So Corbett becomes a particularly good example for him of someone he can satirise. He sees him as the classic example of the parliamentarian elites. You know, these people are officious, they're cynical, they are untrustworthy, and as the wonderfully titled poem, A Brief Relation of the Idiotisms and Absurdities of Miles Corbett, Esquire, Counselor at Law, Recorder and Burgess for Great Yarmouth, they're idiots. he creates a wonderful 18-page pamphlet poem, which lists 11 idiotisms in total.
And you're going to recite the 18 pages?
Sadly, the last couple of pages have been damaged, but I will have to bring up some wonderful passages on the Corbett trial. This isn't the first time he attacks Corbett. He does create a satirical parliamentary speech, which is allegedly by Corbett, which again shows his gullibility and his cruelty. And there's another one, 1641, which brings up the witchcraft case again, allegedly about the sort of things that Corbett's done in the year 1641. In the idiotisms, we have, Bergie, allegedly Corbett presents a dog to the sessions for the crime of stealing some meat and accuses a man of stealing his own goods. Even saw him getting drunk in the sand dunes outside the town, in particular by Corbett's credulousness, his ill education that means he sees Brian as such a threat. It is a really good way to show the recorder's supposed injustice, credulity, and ignorance. So again, he can ridicule the recorder, he can ridicule Puritanism. Again, it's something that we can come back to because it's a theme that develops later, particularly after the Restoration, and about how people view witch hunting in general, which is part of the sort of end of that. But in this case, it's particularly useful because he spends so much local detail trying to explain this case and explain why Corbett is useless. But he also does it in a way that feels quite modern. That what he ridicules isn't that somehow Prynne is a particularly skilled astrologer. He's just a con man. And it's part of the expression of the idiotism of Corbett, is that he falls for this con man and sees him as a real danger, as just this sort of part-time crook. There was a juggling, cunning man of fame, a nicknamed conjurer, Mark Prynne by name, whose skill was in astrology so great that by that art he many folks did cheat. This Mark, pray mark me now that what here I write could many fiends and planets recite. And more strange magic words from him would drop that are in an apothecary's shop. There's a lovely bit where he describes where Thomas Cheshire has proven that Prynne is innocent. The substance of the book did straight explain to be as far from Master Corbett's talk as oatmeal is from eggs or cheese from chalk. And by that book's virtue, we dare both to swear that no man can ever be a conjurer. They therefore prayed the jury to conceive the law cannot this man of life bereave. By their verdict, Prynne not guilty found and escaped a Popham chick tick sky and ground. And there the learned recoverer gained much credit, as some said, if they did not lie that said it. So yeah, it's stirring stuff. You can imagine around a pub after a few drinks.
What ultimately happens with Mark Prynne?
This is the thing that, again, intrigues me with so much of this. That ultimately, I don't know. He's found not guilty. He disappears from the records. Obviously, we know that Lelieve's almanacs continue into 1661. But we don't really hear much more about Prynne. It doesn't help that I've seen about four or five different spellings of his last name, anywhere from prime to prince. And I know that Marion Gibson's new book is going to go from the ground up. I'm sure she'll have some tasty tidbits for us about his life and career. But sadly, this is where his story ends. Obviously, a court case triumph for him, but sadly, no further details on that.
Which, I mean, we find that over and over. We have these court cases. They're intriguing. There's some details. We get a look into a life, and then that's the last word.
Just lucky to have this much snapshots of him and Alice's Bradwell that mean we can build a sort of picture of their life and their beliefs. And again, how these beliefs are changing, which I think is the most fascinating thing. I think one of the interesting elements in England is how this represents the peak of witchcraft beliefs, and how already some of the themes of cynicism and rejection of witchcraft are starting to drop in. Obviously, there's still people like Joseph Glanville talking about witchcraft into the 1680s. But by 1660s, we have Hudibras, the great epic poem about the life of the Restoration, but also looking back at what had happened in England during the Civil Wars and Commonwealth. And again, one of the first mentions we get of Hopkins and his reputation, along with the myth that he himself was hanged as a witch. So certainly that spirit of seeing the Puritan enthusiasm as being falling for fraudsters, or an over-enthusiasm about this, is already coming out of Taylor's work in the middle of the 1640s. That these themes of how Puritanism is seen as an overreaction. It's interesting how this story is having much wider resonances.
What happened to Corbett with the Restoration?
He's elected to Parliament, and then people remember he's one of the regicides. He's the last person to sign the King's death warrant. So there's a general pardon, apart from the regicide. So he escapes to the Netherlands. So he's there with a group of the regicides, and he's eventually caught in a daring raid by George Downing. If you want to know for this detail, Charles Spencer's Kiss of the King has a very vivid account of this. He's brought back, and he has a sort of a touching last meal with his wife, who we talked about. He's obviously kept a record of her life alongside his, and is then executed for treason. So hanged, drawn, quartered, as you'd expect. So rather a grim end.
Is there anything else you wanted to touch on today?
I also would recommend Bernard Capp. Bernard Capp is a really excellent writer in general on Stuart culture, but in particular in this account, he's written a very good biography of John Taylor and his fascinating life, but also on astrology more generally. Definitely worth a check if you want to find out more of this stuff.
And now for Minute with Mary.
November 23rd, 2023 was the last time that I visited Salem for at least 1 year. It was a special visit because I went to Proctor's Ledge not only to pay my respects to the 19 men and women who were hanged there in 1692, I also memorialized 19 men and women who were wrongfully accused and murdered for practicing sorcery and black magic as recent as October of 2023. These innocent women and men named came from countries such as Nigeria, South Africa, India, and the United States of America. I also tell the listener when that person died and the circumstances of their brutal deaths. I urge you to watch this video on YouTube titled End Witch Hunts at Proctor's Ledge. The link to the video will be in the show notes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Sarah has End Witch Hunts News.
End Witch Hunt News, a nonprofit organization. Weekly news update. Thank you for joining us again this new year in unraveling obscure yet familiar witch hunt stories. True stories that persistently unfold in violence and the death of vulnerable and innocent society members today. We anticipate engaging with you each week as we navigate diverse and nuanced perspectives on magic, witchcraft, and the spiritual and supernatural across time, governments, cultures, and religions. We must all respond to the destructive role of witchcraft fear-driven actions, exploring the intricacies of both historical witch trials and the ongoing crisis of witch hunting alongside experts provides us with the necessary insights to take meaningful action. Witch hunts are a disturbing reality that persists, and as part of our podcast community, you play a crucial role in the collective advocacy. Thank you for tuning in, sharing our episodes, continuing the conversation with your sphere of influence, and asking leaders to take action. Very recently in Malawi, there has been a heartbreaking incident of an elderly woman nearly buried alive after being accused of witchcraft. Recent podcast guest and Malawi advocate Wonderful Kuche reported that the sister of the accused witch passed away suddenly after a headache. The accusers then spread rumors attributing the death to magical harm caused by the accused. The victim was rescued just in time by the police, but all the perpetrators must be brought to justice. A statement from Advocacy for Alleged Witches reads, "We urge the government of Malawi to take all necessary measures to combat witchcraft accusations and witch persecution. Authorities should ensure that alleged witches are protected and witchcraft accusers, including those who aid and abet witch hunting in the communities, are punished. But this isn't isolated to Africa. There were individuals burned and killed just a few weeks before the end of 2023 in India as well. In one incident, in Assam Sonitpur district, a 30-year-old woman was brutally assaulted and set ablaze by a neighbor and accomplices. The motive behind the tragic attack was reportedly rooted in accusations of witchcraft harm against the accuser. While attacks are still happening, there are advocates and organizations working to intervene. Please learn about these efforts and support them in any way you are able to. Take the action that you can. We must continue to cultivate societal values of compassion, understanding, and justice. It is our collective responsibility as a world community to unite against the inhumane treatment of every innocent individual anywhere in the world, such as these women falsely accused of causing harm with witchcraft. Spread awareness. Share this information with your friends, family, and on social media. Use your voice to let others know about the urgency of combating witchcraft accusations and persecution. Support advocacy groups. Organizations like the Advocacy for Alleged Witches are on the front line, fighting against such atrocities. Consider supporting them and similar groups dedicated to ending witch hunting. Contact authorities. Raise your voice by reaching out to relevant authorities and leadership. Urge them to take swift and decisive action to ensure justice for victims and accountability for all involved. End Witch Hunts actively supports exoneration and memorial efforts that aim to honor victims and raise witch hunt awareness. Take a stand for justice. Sign our petition at change.org/witchtrials to urge the state of Massachusetts to amend legislation, ensuring the inclusion of all those wrongfully executed for witchcraft in the Massachusetts colony. 5 women faced unjust executions for witchcraft in 17th century Boston, and it's time to clear their names. Let's persist in elevating the voices of both historical and contemporary victims of witch hunts. Unlock the power of supporting our podcast by becoming a monthly donor. Our monthly donors are our super listeners. As a super listener, your monthly contributions make a significant impact. Visit our website and easily sign up for any donation amount that suits you. Your generosity fuels the content you love.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the first episode of Witch Hunt.
Witch Hunt, can't wait to meet with you next week.
So subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Be sure to visit at our new website, witchhuntshow.com.
And remember to tell all your friends, families, and anybody you meet on the street all about Witch Hunt, your favorite podcast.
Support our efforts to end witch hunts. Visit endwitchhunts.org to learn more.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.